to just welcome everyone to Citizens Climate University. It's a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobbies that provides CCL supporters with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics related to climate change and effective climate advocacy. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and tonight's topic is carbon pricing and the Clean Air Act. Various current carbon tax proposals include provisions streamlining Clean Air Act regulations. Reasonably, this causes concern among climate advocates. And tonight, what our webinar is really focusing on is covering the important history of the Clean Air Act and how Clean Air Act regulations might interact with federal carbon pricing. Dr. Astoria is with us, and he teaches political science and law at the University of Wisconsin, where he's been recognized as an outstanding educator by Phi Delta Kappa. He's completed a chapter on greenhouse gas mitigation and utility law for a forthcoming Oxford University Press book. He's also the group leader for CCL's Racine Kenosha chapter and liaison to the Office of the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. Professor Astoria has recently published on several aspects of international trade and greenhouse gas mitigation policy, including carbon border adjustments. So bottom line, he's the perfect guy for the job tonight. We're glad to have him on. And hopefully, as attendees tonight, at the end, you'll be leaving with the following three learning goals: to have more confidence in describing the history and regulatory architecture of the Clean Air Act, to understand where to find and begin to interpret EPA regulations that govern greenhouse gases in the Federal Registrar and Code of Federal Regulations, and then lastly, also to begin utilizing a framework that Ross is going to walk us through for really evaluating how greenhouse gas regulations interact with carbon pricing legislation out there. So without further ado, Ross, the floor is yours, and we are so lucky to have you tonight. Thank you so much for making time, and take it away from here.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Brett. That was very nice. Welcome, everybody. Glad everyone can make it here, and I'm going to talk about kind of administrative law. What does that mean in a general way? I'm going to go over the Clean Air Act, and it's kind of what I call its architecture. I'm going to look at the EPA greenhouse gas regulations that the EPA had put out over the Obama administration, and then we're going to pivot a little, I suppose, from looking at kind of high level, you know, architecture and policy type stuff. And we'll look at specific regulations. So we'll look at the Clean Power Plan, and then we'll develop a kind of rough and ready evaluative framework for thinking about how carbon pricing and carbon fee and dividend interacts with the Clean Air Act regulations. And then we'll take a look at the Market Choice Act, which is the recent bill out of Representative Curbelo's office, which includes some regulatory streamlining language. And so we'll look at how the specific language starts to line up with the regulations, and we'll do a little tour through some of that language, do kind of final takeaways, and then questions and answers. So that's kind of that's the agenda. So let's get started. All right. So I'm going to develop here, I call this the schoolhouse rock model of policy formation. And this starts with bullet one here is you have some sort of policy coalition, some sort of majority of the populace or some sort of minority of the populace that is politically powerful, and they get the Congress to pass some sort of bill. So the policy coalition passes some legislation, which is an enabling statute. And I call these things enabling statutes because largely what legislation in the contemporary area does is it takes some existing administrative agency, in our case, the Environmental Protection Agency, and and that statutory language says, okay, EPA, we want you to achieve these goals with regulations. Now go do that regulating. And the EPA does point number three here, administrative implementation occurs. So the EPA or the FTC or whatnot will start passing regulations that attempt to achieve the goals set out in the statute. And that was a very simplified model there. At that point, what happens are judicial challenges. And the judiciary, the third branch of government under our Constitution, kind of has the duty and responsibility of supervising regulatory agencies under the Administrative Procedures Act. And there are two types of ways that an entity might challenge an administrative regulation. One is the ultra vires challenge. And ultra means beyond, and vires is something like power. So an ultra vires challenge is a challenge where an entity goes, hey, look, EPA, you passed this regulation and the regulation is not in fact well-founded in the statutory text. So you've gone beyond your powers assigned to you in the enabling statute, in the Clean Air Act or whatever the statute has to be. And therefore, Supreme Court or lower court, you need to strike down this statute and scrub it from the Code of Federal Regulations or go back and revise it or something like this. So the judiciary is always there available to litigants to challenge regulations. And then the second type of challenge, which I mentioned here, but we won't be dealing with in this lecture, is a constitutional challenge. So you could also go back and you could challenge the constitutionality of the statute itself. And you could say that the statute has gone beyond the powers assigned to the Congress in the Constitution. All right, so one of our enabling statutes here, and one that's most pertinent to climate advocates, is the Clean Air Act. And I'm going to just go over the architecture of the Clean Air Act, which is a very large and complicated set of statutory language, but it has some pretty distinctive architectural features. And so one thing that the Clean Air Act does is it distinguishes between mobile sources of pollutions and stationary sources. So the mobile pollutions are basically automobiles. And then the stationary sources are power plants and maybe some manufacturing. And the general idea here is that one thing that the Congress was thinking about here is the mobile sources of pollution are cars which cross state boundaries. And so the Congress wanted to make sure that those mobile sources were subject to basically one set of standards under the statute, with a notable exception for California, which I'm going to leave aside for now, but we can come back to California if there's any questions. And then stationary sources, those are the power plants, coal-fired power plants, natural gas-fired power plants, and to some extent, smelters and manufacturers of fluorinated gases and that sort of thing. Those could all come under the stationary sources category. So that's one architectural distinction made by the Clean Air Act. A second aspect of the Clean Air Act is the identification of what's called criteria pollutants and NAAQS. And NAAQS stands for National Ambient Air Quality Standards. But the idea here is that the Clean Air Act identifies a set of chemical compounds, which largely they have a deleterious effect upon the respiratory health of human beings, but maybe also on the ability of plants to do photosynthesis and whatnot. So this is particulate matter, which you breathe into your lungs. And some interesting things that I've learned about particulate matter is there are these studies which show that in areas with high particulate matter, people have more heart attacks. And for a long time, I couldn't figure out why this was, but it turns out some of the particulate matter is actually so small that when you breathe it into your lungs, it gets absorbed through the alveoli and into the bloodstream. So if you happen to have a blood clot and you're breathing bad air, that the particulate matter can get into your bloodstream and knock your blood clots out. So that's why heart attacks increase when there's particulate matter. It also includes sulfur oxides, nitrous oxides, ozone, but largely stuff which harms human beings because of a kind of a physical contact. The second type of, the third architectural point here is that the Clean Air Act makes a distinction between sources that are already in existence at the time of the passage of the Clean Air Act in 1970 versus new sources that are built after the passage of the act. And this has led to some kind of weird results. To the extent that this distinction was founded in good policy, the thinking here was okay, so we have these existing plants, they're kind of polluting, and at one point in the near future, and then in 10, 15 years, they're going to be at the end of their useful life, and we'll retire them. And then what we want to do is not put those under too much regulatory pressure. But on the other hand, we want to make sure that all these sources of pollution are subject to the most rigorous standards, so that when we kind of whack out the old sources, the new sources are very clean. So that is to the extent that there's a good policy foundation for that distinction. That's it. Now, what ended up happening, and this is something to keep track of when we think about regulations, is those old plants, rather than retiring themselves, they just kept producing and producing and producing. All right, and so instead of retiring them, the owners just kept them up and running as long as possible. And so one thing this means for the point of mitigation is, in the United States, we have a coal fleet that is very, very old. And ready to retire. So you put those, you can put those under, you know, if they become under a little bit of pressure, they should become unprofitable very quickly. So the distinction between existing and new sources didn't work out the way people thought it, but we now have a situation where we could maybe take advantage of by thinking about the age of existing plant. The fourth aspect, the fourth architectural point about the Clean Air Act is that it relies upon federalism, and in particular, a subset of federalism that people have called cooperative federalism. The idea of federalism is that we, in each territory in the United States, we have actually two sovereigns. One is the federal sovereign, and the other is the state sovereign. And the idea of federalism, those two sovereigns are kind of contending for power. So they're putting each other under checks and balances, if you will. But then each is supposed to have its own distinctive kind of policy field where it is allowed to regulate. And in particular, part of the thinking here is, or was with federalism, that the states would be really good at policy formation and regulation of the stuff that happens in their borders. But once things start crossing borders, then you want the federal government to be able to regulate. And the way that that plays out in the Clean Air Act statute is at the federal level, the EPA sets the NAAQS, the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, and those are largely, but not exclusively, uniform across the country. But then the states have the option of implementing the regulations that meet the National Ambient Air Quality Standards. And those are done through a regulatory instrument called a State Implementation Plan, or SIP, and we'll come back to SIPs when we talk about the Clean Power Plan. But the general idea with cooperative federalism, and this is a very common feature of a lot of statutes these days, is that the federal government will set the standard, or will set the policy goal with respect to the regulatory outcome, and then the states will take it upon themselves to actually do the regulation that meets that goal. With respect to the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, that means the EPA says, okay, this density of particulate matter in the air is safe, and any density of particulate matter above that concentration is unsafe. And then states will go, okay, we want to use our own, in Wisconsin it's called the Department of Natural Resources. We're going to use our own Department of Natural Resources, our own state staff, to enforce regulations within the state that will meet those National Ambient Air Quality Standards. Under the Clean Air Act, if you don't enforce the statutes, the federal government can come in and do the enforcing. A state could also have highway funding denied to it under the Clean Air Act. But all those operations of the federal government depend upon there being an EPA and an EPA administrator who's willing to kind of take those actions. Okay, so we have gotten to, I think, Lorene's question here about, like, how does carbon dioxide fit into this framework? So carbon dioxide is not a criteria pollutant, which are listed in the statute. It also doesn't seem to be a toxic pollutant, in that you know, when you come in contact to it, it doesn't cause any immediate deleterious effects. So how does it fit in here? And this is kind of an epic story of how some individuals in some states got carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases classified as an air pollutant. So what I'm showing you here is Section 202, which is in the mobile source category of the Clean Air Act. The language here basically says if there's the EPA administrator has to regulate any air pollutant which endangers public health or welfare. And the question here is the air pollutant in this language doesn't say whether or not carbon dioxide is or is not an air pollutant. And so in the next slide, you can see the Clean Air Act definition of air pollutant from Section 302. It's self-referential, of course. So the term air pollutant means any air pollutant agent or combination of agents, including physical, chemical, biological, radiative substance. So it's a pretty open and capacious definition, right? If it's a physical substance and it goes into the air, it can be an air pollutant. In the late Clinton administration, so in 97 or 98, the EPA saw that the Kyoto Protocol wasn't going to work, and they started to think about regulatory solutions using existing statutory language. And some states and some environmental nonprofits petitioned the EPA in 99, and they asked the EPA to declare carbon dioxide to be an air pollutant under that statutory language I just showed you. The Bush administration comes in 2001, and the Bush administration EPA denies the petition that of classifying carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. And Whitman was the EPA administrator at that time, and she had been in the late 90s the governor of New Jersey. And New Jersey had been during that time on the forefront of thinking about carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases. So it's really interesting to go back and think to, this is now 15 years ago, how this could have turned out kind of differently. There were opportunities and bipartisan opportunities even back then, but it kind of turns out that the EPA is going to decide to deny the petition for declaring carbon dioxide an air pollutant under Section 202, and the petitioners begin to litigate, and they litigate an ultra vires challenge, and they say, this basically, EPA, the statute is clear that carbon dioxide is an air pollutant, and so you have to declare it an air pollutant, and you have to start regulating it. And that litigation goes up through the court system all the way to the Supreme Court, which is pretty odd. The Supreme Court usually only weighs in on heavy stuff, and it declares, it finds in the case of Massachusetts versus EPA that in fact carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases are an air pollutant. So maybe. And so here's the holding from Justice Stevens, now retired. He says carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, and hydrofluorocarbons are without a doubt, quote, physical and chemical substances which are emitted into the ambient air. The statute is unambiguous. And I love this quote. The statute is unambiguous. It's kind of ironic because this is in 2007, and it took 10 years of some of the smartest, best Clean Air Act lawyers litigating this to get to what Justice Stevens considers here to be unambiguous. So from 2007 on, for purposes of the Clean Air Act, carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases are air pollutants, right? And the EPA can start regulating them under the Clean Air Act framework. And here's what the EPA starts to put together. So in 2008, both Obama and McCain kind of go with a cap and trade system. Both of those kind of fail, except that the Waxman-Markey passed the House in 2009, and the EPA issues what is called the endangerment finding. And what the endangerment finding says is, okay, carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases are air pollutants for the purposes of the Clean Air Act, and those greenhouse gases endanger human health and welfare. And this is a long document, and what it basically does is it goes through all of the science from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and scientists, and it shows that the impacts of greenhouse of global warming are going to, in fact, impact human health. In 2010, the cap and trade bill fails in Congress, and in 2010-2011, the EPA starts to regulate the greenhouse gas emissions from mobile sources. And what those look like are what we call CAFE standards, which is corporate average fuel economy standards. So those mobile source standards say, okay, you've got to have a certain fuel economy for your corporate fleet. And you've got to make sure that a car goes so many miles per gram of carbon dioxide emitted into the atmosphere. The next thing that the EPA does is it puts out stationary source performance standards for carbon dioxide in 2013. And so remember, one of the architectural distinctions in the Clean Air Act is between new sources and existing sources. So it does the new sources first. And then in 2015, the Obama administration puts out the regulations for existing sources, and that's what we call the Clean Power Plan, which is probably everyone here was watching the news that I guess we could call it recently deceased. So the Clean Power Plan is I'm going to get all the dates wrong, but it's proposed in 2015, and then the final plan comes out in 2016, and the Attorney General from West Virginia stays up late into the morning to make sure that when the ultra-virus challenge filed against the Clean Power Plan comes out, that West Virginia is at the top of the list and is the named plaintiff. Very strangely, the litigation begins, and there's an appeal from the lower court to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court stays a lower court decision on the Clean Power Plan, and it then went into kind of stasis, I suppose, and it remained in stasis until, I guess, just last week, the Trump EPA proposed a revision to the Clean Power Plan. And so, like I said, recently deceased, but one thing I wanted to do with this is show you how the Clean Power Plan, should it come back into effect, which it could in another administration, would maybe interact with carbon price. All right, so when the EPA wanted to regulate existing sources, which would be existing coal-fired power plants, but also existing natural gas plants largely, it looked to the statutory language of the Clean Air Act, and it decided that any regulations had to meet these four criteria here on the left. So it needed to be a system of emission reduction. That system needed to be adequately demonstrated. It needed to be the best considering the cost and energy requirements, and it had to be achievable. And after looking at that and thinking about how the energies, the electrical power system worked, the EPA proposed, in the Clean Power Plan, proposed these four points. The first building block, they called them, was a heat rate improvement, which is basically facility level efficiency, to make your coal-fired power plant more efficient. The second was running existing natural gas more often, that is increasing the capacity factor. And the reason that would reduce emissions is that you get more power out of one. So for every ton of carbon dioxide emitted burning natural gas, you get more heat than compared to coal. And then the third building block here was rely upon or build more renewable generation. And the fourth proposed power block, building block here, is user side efficiency. So that would be the consumer side. And we've got this in italics here because that was proposed, but it wasn't included in the final plan. And I like to mention this because I'm pretty sure almost every climate advocate has seen by now that efficiency, user side efficiency, is always, always the cheapest way to mitigate greenhouse gases. And yet the EPA felt that the statutory language of the Clean Air Act did not allow it to kind of require or implement user side efficiency. So I like to show that here, how the language of the Clean Air Act it has its limitations in terms of achieving mitigation. All right, and what I want to do here now is to take those three aspects of the Clean Power Plan, and I want to think about how those three would interact with a carbon price such as the Citizens Climate Lobby advocates for. So the idea of the carbon price is you would take the fossil fuel and you would add a price to that fossil fuel in accordance with the amount of carbon dioxide or greenhouse gases that were produced by that fuel. And so we want a system here, and this is one system of many that we might use, but we want a way to think about, okay, will this carbon price make this or that regulation redundant? And one of my colleagues in the Clean Air Act world named Justin Gundlach has put together a very nice paper called To Negotiate a Carbon Tax, a Rough Map of Interactions. And if you had time and you were interested in this, I would recommend you read that. But he sets out three different ways he thinks that a carbon price, and he talks about a carbon price generally, might interact with different types of regulation. So he says the regulation might be concurrent to the carbon price. So here he says, apply more than one instrument, not only to the same ultimate goal, but to the same implement. They might be complementary. So the regulation might intensify the effects of a carbon tax to a material degree. Complementary means the regulation improves the efficacy of the carbon tax in producing mitigation. Concurrent means that the carbon tax and the regulation are achieving the same end. And then conflicting, the last one, means that there's something about the regulatory policy that conflicts with the carbon tax. The regulation kind of actively incentivizes the production and burning of fossil fuels. Okay. So if the, if the regulation is conflicting, then you definitely want to use a carbon pricing bill to change it. Right. So one thing you might advocate for is, all right, we're going to change the definition of master limited partnership when we put a price on carbon. And we're going to make sure that there's no special taxing structure anymore. If the regulation is complementary, like PACE, then you want to make sure that either remains in place when you pass a carbon bill, or you want to maybe actually affirmatively introduce it into the legislation. And then if the regulation is concurrent, then you take a really close look to think about whether or not you can streamline that regulation out of the portfolio. If the regulation and the carbon tax are redundant, then the regulation can they can affirmatively kind of increase compliance costs for facilities. If they're concurrent, then you might actually be squeezing out some of the, you know, one thing about a carbon price that's beneficial is the facility kind of receives the carbon price signal, but then they can respond to it any way they want. If there's a concurrent regulation in place, then it limits the number of responses they might be able to take. So I think that's Justin's basic assessment there. Those are the three categories we might place a regulation, and then we can start the evaluation there. So let's apply those three categories to the three aspects of the Clean Power Plan, and I think this is what we get. Again, so this is a quick first take, but the first building block was heat rate intensity. So that was make your coal-fired power plant more efficient. So if you put a carbon price, a carbon tax on coal-fired power plants, then the coal-fired power plant will probably take those heat rate intensity efficiency measures anyway. So it looks like the heat rate intensity requirement of the Clean Power Plan and a carbon tax are concurrent, right? They achieve the same end. All right, so the second point of the Clean Power Plan is fuel switch to natural gas. Again, these appear to be concurrent because what will happen under a carbon price is, since natural gas produces energy more efficiently than coal, this should mean that natural gas will, the power from natural gas will be cheaper than the power from coal in the wholesale market. And so natural gas power. So those look like they're concurrent. And the third aspect is rely upon build more renewable energy generating. So again, these appear to be concurrent. So what will happen under carbon price is the cost of energy from coal and natural gas will increase. And that means the renewable power in the wholesale market should be switched online and made to produce more. So quick take home point, and there's a lot of, that was very quick. So one would maybe want to go back and provide more detail of that, but that's just a quick sample of how one might think through that. And then I've got three more samples here of kind of regulatory or policy frameworks, which are not concurrent, but there's a different take on those. So I'll run these through really quick. So there's a policy called PACE, which is Property Assessed Clean Energy. And this is a way for owners of commercial facilities or a house to take to basically finance their rooftop solar or their battery by putting the financing into their property tax base. And so what this does is it makes financing cheaper for homeowners and commercial producers. So that's probably a complementary policy, in that you take the carbon price, which would increase the cost of power from coal-fired power plant, and then the property assessed clean energy would make the production of your own power cheaper on your house because it would reduce the financing costs. The second set of regulations here we'll take a look at is appliance efficiency. These are efficiency standards put out for things like your refrigerator by the Department of Energy. And these are probably complementary as well. And the reason is that in many cases, in the landlord-renter case in particular, the owner, the purchaser of the appliance is not the user. And so this means there's something called split incentives. And because there's a split incentive between the landlord to basically buy the cheapest refrigerator while the renter operates it and maybe pays the high electrical bill for that, it means that the carbon price signal won't trickle into the decision as to which appliance to purchase. So appliance efficiency standards are probably complementary to carbon pricing. And then the third one here, and this is probably less well known than most, these are MLPs, Master Limited Partnerships. But these are they're a type of corporation. And the corporation allows for a special taxing structure when the corporation engages in certain types of activities. And right now, those activities are largely activities associated with fossil fuel production and transportation. So a lot of natural gas facilities which pipe natural gas from one place to another are MLPs, right? So that preferential tax status for master limited partnerships probably conflicts with the mitigation effects of a carbon tax because it incentivizes individuals to keep investing in hydrocarbon infrastructure. So unless you change the definition of MLPs, those will remain conflicting. Okay, so I just very quickly took our evaluative framework and I applied it against the three aspects of the Clean Power Plan and three aspects of other kind of policy or regulatory frameworks that might interact with a a carbon price. So I'm going to take a little pause there, and then I will look at how we're doing on time. Okay, we'll take some questions, and I think we're okay on time. I'll look at this particular statutory text that just came out of Representative Curbelo's office. Representative Curbelo introduced his Market Choice Act, I guess about a month ago. And this is the first bill out of the Congress from a Republican office, which prices carbon. And so I wanted us to take a quick look at some of the regulatory rollback language here to see how this works. And I selected this section. It's Section B in the Market Choice Act. And this is on emissions. And so I wanted to point out a little bit about this this language here, just kind of get a sense of how regulatory streamlining can be targeted. So the bill says, unless specifically authorized in sections 202, 211, 213, 231, if emissions of any greenhouse gas is subject to taxation pursuant to any section 9902 through 9903 of the International Internal Revenue Code, the administrator shall not finalize or enforce any rule limiting such emissions under this act on the basis of the emissions greenhouse gas effect. So first thing to notice about this is it starts with a general prohibition on issuing regulations, but then it says, go look at other sections, such as 202, 211, to see if we've added any language there that specifically authorizes additional regulations. All right, so okay, cool. So we're gonna go look to see what's going on in those sections. The second part here is if emissions of any greenhouse gas is subject to taxation. So what's happening there? One, right, is specifically saying we're gonna reduce the EPA's regulatory authority for greenhouse gases only. So it's making a distinction between toxics pollutants, criteria pollutants, and greenhouse gases. So all those other pollutants, the EPA's regulatory authority remains intact. The next section here says that regulatory authority for the EPA is going to be reduced only if that greenhouse gas has been priced under previous sections of the code, right? So if something weird should happen, and by some administrative shenanigans or if some additional bill comes on later, and for some reason that greenhouse gas is no longer priced or taxed, the EPA's regulatory authority kicks back in, all right? And it says the administrator shall not finalize or authorize any rule limiting such emissions under this act on the basis of the emissions greenhouse gas effect. So some greenhouse gases, not carbon dioxide, but methane and nitrous oxide and some of the fluorinated gases, they might also have other pollutant properties that aren't just greenhouse gas effects, right? So they might be on the toxics list, or they might be ozone depleting substances. So the EPA can still regulate the greenhouse gas, just not on the basis of its greenhouse gas effects, but it's on its basis of the other deleterious effects it might have on the environment. All right, some final takeaways. So hopefully what I was trying to do with that analysis of the language here is to show that there's some very specific ways to use this language to kind of take a very narrow flight path between carbon pricing and regulations. And so the first final take home here is regulations just aren't on off. There's a lot of nuance here. And in particular, if we had the time to go through the entire market choice bill, we would see some things like the holding in Massachusetts versus EPA is kept intact, right? So carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases are still air pollutants for purposes of Section 202 and the Clean Act generally. It leaves intact the endangerment finding. It leaves intact all state efforts to regulate carbon or price carbon. And it also leaves intact some other things which we didn't discuss here, but CAFE standards are left intact under the Market Choice Act. The second thing to note here is that the Clean Air Act statutory language it doesn't quite match up with the physical properties of carbon dioxide as a pollutant, but it's the statute we have. And the example I'm thinking of here is when we looked at that potential fourth building block in the Clean Power Plan, right? Consumer side efficiency. Couldn't quite fit that into the statutory language, even though it's almost certainly the cheapest way to reduce carbon emissions. So the statute is really good and it's really cool, but it's not quite clear that it's the best vehicle for reducing greenhouse gas mitigation. And so our final point here is that when we look at the interactions of carbon pricing and the statutes, the Clean Air Act and the regulations that the EPA has put out there under, we want to have some sort of framework or evaluative tool for understanding those interactions. And I use Justin Gundlach's examples of concurrent, complementary, and conflicting as a way to begin that evaluative procedure. Oh, one more slide here. And if you're looking for more here, we've got further resources. And in particular, Brett and I put together an advanced policy camp last summer, and we're putting together another one next summer where we look at these issues in depth. And Katrina Rourke, one of our good partners with the Climate Leadership Council, did the regulatory section last year. And you can see all her materials and her talk on our webpage. David Bookbinder, who is one of the individuals who worked on the Massachusetts versus EPA litigation, has a talk from our one of our past conferences. And then Justin Gundlach's paper is available also.
Quick promo, the sign up, if you're interested in finding out about the early information on next summer's Advanced Climate Policy Camp, you can sign up to be in the know and get an email as soon as registration goes live. It's going to be the Wednesday through Friday ahead of the June conference, next 5th through the 7th. And we'll just highlight that if you do have other questions, feel free to run them my way. My email is just brett@citizensclimate.com. I'm more than happy to pass on to the research team anything out there that we can do to further our training resources and support for the importance of volunteers like you making a difference. And again, if you have any other comments or feedback, we'd love to know about it tonight. But we'll just close by saying thank you. You are the reason why we are making progress, as like Ross has highlighted. And we really just look forward to continuing to work together and seeing you soon.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for your efforts.
Thank you for being here.